Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's very special episode because I am joined once again by my friend, the managing editor of DailyDead.com, the co-host of the Corpse Club podcast, and the author of Monster Squad Volumes 1 and soon Volume 2, the horror chick, top critic, Heather Wixon. Hi, Heather.
Hello. Hi, I know. It's been like forever. I think the last time we actually did anything over for F This Movie was for the Tobe Hooper Day.
Good Lord.
I know. Well, you're
that,
just
that wasn't
too cool.
That. I mean, that was August. That was like the end of August. So that's like 2 months. That's not too bad. But honestly, like since we started doing Corpse Club together, we end up doing this show less. And the fans of F This Movie suffer.
I know. We're sorry, guys. We're sorry.
Your introduction keeps getting longer, so I'm going to need you to do less stuff.
Okay. Well, actually, it's probably going to change a little bit down the road, too. So, in relation to book stuff, but that's nothing we can discuss quite yet.
Oh, cool to spring that on me when we're recording and not before.
Well, I can't really talk about it yet, but there is some really fun stuff on the horizon.
Talk about it to me, not on mic.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's what I'm saying.
No. Nobody's listening, right?
No, please.
Nobody
listens to this. are going to have a very fun conversation this week because I realized that almost every time you come on, Heather, we talk about horror movies with the exception of the one time we talked about wrestling movies.
Yes.
And so I thought it might be fun to have you on to talk about the movies that you love that are not horror movies. So we're going to be talking about the horror chicks non-horror picks. Look at that. I'm like a rhymer.
Ooh.
Yeah. You get that for free.
I don't even know if I'm legally allowed to talk about non-horror movies. I should check my contracts.
Yeah, would you? Just real quick before we start. I don't want to be in breach. Before we get into all that, of course, I have to ask, Heather, have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I know some people love it. Some people have been like, "Eh, it's okay." But I freaking loved Overlord. I think it's a blast. I really enjoyed it at a Fantastic Fest, and now it's actually out in theaters. So I wanted to mention it just because it's very rare that we actually get horror movies in theaters that aren't tied directly to specific properties or sequels or anything like that. And I think it's a really fun movie. I mean, it's very much a Wolfenstein movie without calling it Wolfenstein. Maybe it would have done better had they called it Wolfenstein.
Having never played Wolfenstein, explain to me what that means.
Nazis creating zombies, and then you got to stop them.
Ah, Wolfenstein. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. Got it. Oh, that Wolfenstein. I thought you meant Tim Wolfenstein, famous German filmmaker. Oh, okay. Yes. I got it.
It's Wolfenstein, not Wolfenstein.
Got it.
Playing off a little young Frankenstein there. In case anybody didn't know my obvious joke. I'm the asshole who's like, let me explain to you my obvious joke.
When I say show me the money, yeah, I'm referencing Jerry Maguire.
What? No. And there's a movie coming, depending on when this actually goes up, but there's a movie that comes out November 30th that I just rewatched last week because I hadn't seen it since Fantastic Fest last year, and I wanted to kind of re-immerse myself in it, and it further cemented the fact that it's going to be one of my favorite movies for this year, and it's Anna and the Apocalypse.
Yay! I can't wait for it. I feel like everybody has seen it but me at this point, but I've been dying to see it.
Yeah, it's so damn good. It's just I love movie musicals. Yeah. I love Christmas movie musicals. I love movie musicals that involve zombies. Mm-hmm. It's everything you could possibly want. It's so, this is this tiny little movie from Scotland, and it has more heart in it than any of the TV lately, they've been doing all the musicals live. It's better than any of those that I've seen, especially Rocky Horror. Oh God. that one from last year was painful. I love it. It's so great. The songs are fantastic. The cast is amazing. It actually really has a good emotional core to it. Really gory at times. So I really want people to find that movie. I don't know what Orion, and it's coming out under Orion, which is crazy to me. Cause the opening is like the old Orion credit, like the, you know, title card. And I was like, oh wow, that's fun. So I don't know what their release plans are for it, but
if I think it's Orion has generally done like same day VOD. The few Orion titles I can think of.
I don't know. Cause I think they did. Because Belko, I think, went strictly theatrical.
Shoot, I forgot about Belko. I was thinking of, like, The Domestics and a film by a director who we shall not name.
Ah, wonderful. I know what you're talking about. Okay. But, yeah, so I don't know if this one's going VOD, because I haven't read anything that talks about its VOD release yet. But I do recommend, if you can see it in a theater. It's a really fun crowd movie. I love it. It's really sweet. It's really fun. I'm trying to think of any. I mean, I saw Suspiria for a third time because I'm ridiculous. So, you know, it's funny. I keep thinking like, oh, it's going to get quiet. And like this week alone, I've had like I have to go see a movie tomorrow and cover another thing. And so it's I don't know. Damn it. Why can't horror just be in October like it used to be?
Well, the
late summer.
Here's the good news. Okay. You don't actually have to cover any of this stuff because this has been a really terrible year for horror.
That's what I've heard. I've heard. Actually, I don't even think any real horror movies have come out this year.
I'm almost positive. Was that Vogue that said that?
Yes, because, you know, the fashion magazine is where I go to for all my horror news. So I just here's my whole thing about that. And nobody ever seems to listen, and everybody seems to do the same damn thing and get all angry about it. And honestly, I'm like, yeah, it's really stupid, but I don't really care, because when I see those kind of stupid articles, do you know what I don't do is share them over and over again in anger.
Right.
Because the easiest way to make it go away is to ignore it. Like, nobody ever saw the end of Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, how do you think Nancy defeats Freddy? She ignores him. She takes his power away, and he dissipates. So everybody... those bad takes, they'll dissipate if you just ignore them.
Right.
Or even like one of the Treehouse of Horrors when they turn their backs on all the giant,
just
you know,
don't
advertising.
Look. Right.
Just don't look. And it goes away. It's so amazing. And it's so freeing because everybody was so angry like last week. And I was like, whatever, I'm cool. I'm just moving on because I don't care. You know, it's like, it's one thing if you want to screen cap it and like, you know, call people out on their bad takes. I totally get that. But when you like throw the link in there, like that's when you're just giving them what they want.
Even screen capping it, I mean, you're still giving it legitimacy. Like,
I mean, I get the curiosity of reading it.
Sure.
But sharing it is like, okay, now you're just making it into a thing.
Right. I basically just have not been on social media. So I missed most of the storm about all of that. I did see that it existed.
And I wouldn't say that you missed it.
Well, right.
It's
so
literally the same storm that happens like every 3 months when we get an article like this. So.
I spent half of a second being like, oh, from Vogue, who cares? Like if somebody put out an article that said the sky is green, I wouldn't read it and get angry about it and share it and say, look how wrong they are. I would just be like, yeah, obviously you're wrong and we can all just accept that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
So don't give them the power, kids.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Take it from us old folks.
Did you see Bad Times at the El Royale?
I haven't. It played Fantastic Fest this year and it played the day that I left, so I didn't get a chance to. I wanted to. I was very curious about it because I like Drew Goddard's work a lot. But I kind of missed it, so, and I don't think it's playing in theaters here anymore.
It kind of came and went pretty quickly. I saw it, and I was excited about it. You know, I really like Cabin in the Woods, and I like stuff that Drew Goddard has written, and, man, I feel a little bit let down by it. Like, it is very, very well made. It is beautifully shot, and the production design is really cool, and the cast is good, but, I cannot for the life of me figure out why it's 2.5 hours.
Somebody said it just tries too hard.
It's
like in the second half of the movie. And I don't know necessarily what that means, but maybe that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say anything because obviously I'm not going to give anything away, but I just feel like none of it actually connects. you know, I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say that it's about these different people in this motel, and they each kind of are there for different reasons or have their own stories kind of taking place. And none of them really connect, even when they connect. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, as a screenwriter, you can say these two people bump into each other, but that doesn't actually mean that, like, there's any real connection for us in the audience. I don't, you know, I've heard people that really loved it, so I know that, you know, the world is a rainbow. It just, I was fine watching it, but when it ended, I realized that there was almost nothing there, and it was kind of a bummer.
That is a bummer. Yeah. Especially when you, like, if you have that talent, like, in terms of the cast, like, you know, you've right. got Chris Hemsworth.
Right.
That alone, like, should instill at least a solid, you know, 3 out of 5 right there.
Right. And, like, you know, if it's on cable or at Redbox or something, like, I totally would recommend seeing it. And, you know, part of it for me, too, is, like, I'm not able to get to the theater as much, and so those outings are more and more precious. And so when it's like, oh, man, that was a disappointment, then I'm mad that I didn't go see something else that might not have been. But how can you know for sure?
How do you solve a problem like Maria, I think?
Right.
Is the real question.
Right. The other movie that I'll talk about very briefly is a movie that I saw because our very own Adam Riske has been talking about it for half the year, and that is the crime epic Gotti, starring John Travolta.
Oh my God, why would you do that?
Because he keeps talking about how entertaining it is. Like, he's not saying good, but he keeps saying it's very entertaining.
Was it entertaining?
No. it wasn't.
I'm shocked.
It was. Well, so here's something I didn't know until I was watching the opening credits of Gotti. I knew that it was directed by E from Entourage.
I'm already out right there.
I didn't know. It's written by Lem Dobbs. Yeah, I didn't know it was written by Leo Rossi.
He's like a crazy right-wing guy, I think, now, or something like that.
Well, whatever. It's,
I know.
He clearly wrote it after watching every mob movie ever made, because, whatever.
Oh,
I swear to God, if you switched out, you don't even have to switch anyone out. It plays like a Funnier Die sketch. Like, it's... It's the parody of a mob movie that, like, other characters go to see in their own movie. It is, you watch John Travolta and you can't figure out how he's ever acted before and been good. Like, he's, you know, been great. And it's just bad choice after bad choice. It makes no sense. I don't even understand what the point of view is. It's like one of those, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. Like, it's not telling us anything about organized crime in America. It's not giving us any insight about John Gotti as a person. It's literally just, here's some things that happened all out of order.
That's a bummer, because, like, I know everybody has some mixed feelings about John Travolta, and whatever, that's fine. I generally find him entertaining. I think he was incredible in A Valley of Violence.
Yeah, he's great in that.
And, you know, it's one of those, I wish more people, like, talked about that movie, because that movie is really fantastic. It has some amazing performances in it. I even think, like, Tessa is so good in that movie, too. I don't understand how he goes from, like, being so on, like, dialed into something, and then the next thing he does, he's, like, completely removed. You know, I mean, like, there's things like, you know, and I think there's a similarity maybe in some cases for somebody like Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
Who you watch stuff and you're like, oh, you can tell he is completely dialed into this project. And then you watch, like, another movie and you're like, wait, where does Nicolas Cage go? you know, and I think that's sort of, it's interesting that, you know, you sort of have these actors who've been working steadily in the industry for like 40 years now. And it's just weird to me that, like, if you're John Travolta, like, shouldn't you just be dialed in all the time? Like, you know, you've legitimately done some great things in your career.
To me, so, Travolta is always dialed in. Like, he's one of these guys who shows up in, like, every fifth garbage, like, kind of Redbox or VOD movie. It's him, Nicolas Cage, Bruce Willis, and Cusack. And Cusack and Bruce Willis never give a shit. Like, they are never dialed in. They are just collecting paychecks. Nicolas Cage is kind of hit or miss, right? You can tell when he's connected and when he's not. For me, the ones that I've seen of Travolta, and I will admit I haven't seen everything, but even something like Gotti, like, he is trying his ass off, and that almost makes it worse, because it's just like, this is not worth the effort. The effort is not working out for you, JT. It was, the whole thing just was weirdly embarrassing to watch, like, for everyone involved.
Yeah, I think the last time speaking of John Cusack, I think the last time I saw anything that he really seemed to be enjoying the work and actually wanting to be a part of it was probably Grand Piano.
Yeah, that was fun. He did, I can't remember the name of it, he did that Lucky McKee movie where he's trying to kill the kids in the woods.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that one.
It's okay. It's, you know, maybe my least favorite Lucky McKee movie, but Cusack seems kind of invested. And is giving a sort of an interesting performance. He's not completely sleepwalking, which is cool.
But isn't it sad that we've reached the point that some of these actors that we grew up loving were like, we just literally need you to not sleepwalk through a role and be happy.
Right.
And these are some like really fantastic actors. Like if you think about like where Cusack came from, with like The Grifters and like Say Anything and Gross Point Blank and High Fidelity, like it just makes me like so sad. Like all you have to do is try a little.
This
is your job.
This is your job. At different points in their careers, both Cusack and Nicolas Cage were people that I considered my favorite actors, you know? Like I was all in on both of them. And I know, you know, Nicolas Cage is having kind of a resurgence this year thanks to Mom and Dad and especially Mandy. And that's, you know, very rewarding. But I already know that, like, when Glass comes out, that half of the reviews are going to be like, yeah, Bruce Willis seems to actually give a shit, as though he deserves credit for doing his job. But anytime he, like, sort of cares, we all just celebrate him. It's very weird.
I know. I honestly wish I cared about Glass. I really don't. I know it's terrible and it's blasphemy. I like Unbreakable. I didn't really like Split that much. So I
didn't really either.
No, I'm like, I don't understand why we care about this guy who likes to torture women and keep them chained up and we're treating that like something cool. Yeah. I don't know. It's weird. It's weird to me. Like I saw the trailer and I think the trailer looks really interesting and I'll see it because, you know, that's part of the gig. But I'm not invested in it really whatsoever. I don't know. It makes me a bad person, I know.
No, I mean, for me, you know, at this point, it's a curiosity. How is he going to do this, you know, and which M. Night Shyamalan will we get? You know, is this, because I still don't think he's quite returned to form. Like, I thought The Visit was okay. I thought Split was okay.
I like The Visit. Yeah, I like The Visit more than Split.
Okay.
Split for me just had, for what they were trying to do with it, I just feel like it had so many sort of false logic parts to it. Like, it just, there's a lot to me that didn't work. I thought Anya Taylor-Joy was really good in it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm totally blinking on what's his face.
McAvoy.
I think he's really good in it. But I just think for what it's a slightly insulting look at mental illness.
That's every M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Yeah. And I just, you know, and I get that we fear these things because we don't always understand them, but that doesn't also make it okay for people who are committing crimes in your movies to be celebrated. I don't know. Whatever. It's complicated. I have complicated feelings about his career, but I do like The Visit, even though, again, you know, old people going through Alzheimer's, you know, and suddenly we're making them into monsters. But it is a terrifying disease. So,
sure. There's times, and I don't want to spoil any M. Night Shyamalan movies, but there are times when, you know, his early movies I really liked because he seemed to be taking these supernatural or science fiction or whatever you want to call them, these kind of genre-specific ideas, and then treating them very realistically. If there really were ghosts, maybe this is what it would be like. If there really were superheroes, it might be something like this. If aliens really came down, maybe it would go like this. And then at a certain point, he flipped And he started taking what seems like supernatural ideas and then telling us, no, it's just regular stuff. And the visit to me was much more interesting when it seemed to be going down a path of, you know, more actual horror stuff instead of what it ends up being. And the village does kind of the same thing. I mean, there's a handful of movies where it's like, oh, this would have been way more interesting if you had just gone seen it through. I guess Split sort of does. I don't want to spoil any of these movies for people, but
yeah, I think for me The Village was where I kind of checked out, because I swear to God, in junior high I read a short story that was exactly the setup of The Village.
Oh yeah.
So about 20 minutes into The Village, I didn't want to be like that guy. I see it coming, but I literally leaned over to my ex and basically was like, this is what's going on. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And I was like, I know I read a story that was just like this. I still haven't been able to figure out if that was just like me dreaming or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, but I swear I was like, oh, I know exactly what this is. And I was right. And I was kind of a bummer. Like, I wanted it to be the premise that was set up in that movie.
Yes, what a more interesting movie.
Yeah, and it was even enough for me to overlook, like, sort of Adrian Brody being there.
Oh, boy. Speaking of M. Night's problems with mental illness.
Yeah,
weird. Anyway, let's talk about some non-horror movies.
All right.
You are known as one of the premier voices in the horror community on the internet, having written
five people,
please,
and two of them are you and me, maybe.
You are a top critic.
I actually don't even believe that.
You are a top critic, and everyone loves you, and looks to you for your wisdom when it comes to horror. But you are so much more than just a person who loves horror. You love all kinds of movies. And so I thought it would be fun to talk about. Now, I limited it to five. I know that you have more than five favorite non-horror movies. So at the end, you should definitely list off, like, here's a bunch of movies that you didn't name, but that you also love.
Okay. I mean, realistically, like, I'm kind of a basic bitch. So it was, like, really hard for me not to just, like, list off a bunch of, like, 80s romantic comedies.
All right.
So I was going to go the other way where I'm like, everything is like The Godfather.
Ooh.
Like, those are my, you know what I mean? Like, you have to do the hoity-toity movies, right, where I'm like, 400 Blows is my favorite non-horror movie. Like, sure, I saw it and I loved it, but it's not a movie I revisit very often.
Right.
So yeah, when I did this, I basically, it was one of those where I was like, it's movies that I tend to revisit a lot. They sort of changed me in one way or another.
Okay.
So, you know.
Right,
and I omitted Dirty Dancing because I didn't want to be embarrassed.
You left it off completely?
I did.
Wow.
But it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
Did Dirty Dancing Havana Nights make the cut?
That's number one.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
All right. So what would... now, are these ranked or are these just like five favorites?
Five. I mean, I kind of am saving like the best for last.
Okay.
But, you know, I think... sort of my five, like, I'm kind of going in like a descending order in my brain.
So ranked is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of. I mean, it would be hard for me to actually put a numerical value on these.
Of course.
So
I just want to make sure if I'm saying like, all right, so what's your number five? What's your number four? That people understand what that means.
Yes.
Anyway, so what is your number five?
So my number five is Desperado.
Interesting.
Yes. So, you know, and you know this because you're the same, you know, you're older than me. But like,
easy.
You know, so the 90s were like a really interesting time for film, I think. And it was right after, of course, discovering Clerks, which almost made my list. And I didn't really know much about Robert Rodriguez. And then one day I rented El Mariachi, just because we were renting all kinds of artsy movies, just because I had friends, like, we were in all that kind of weird stuff. And so I remember I actually, like, went and saw Desperado in theaters. And it opened the same weekend, I think, as Mortal Kombat. And I remember I was on a double date. My friends, Selena and her boyfriend, they opted for Mortal Kombat. And myself and the guy I was dating at the time, we opted for Desperado because, you know, we're the smart couple. But it was really interesting because, like, he was kind of a prude, so he was very uncomfortable in the movie, and I was completely immersed. It's literally, like, the one movie where I was ready to, like, basically go home with both the male and the female lead in that movie.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, totally. Oh, my God. Salma Hayek in that movie is just amazing. There's so much I love about that movie. It really opened me up to Antonio Banderas as an actor. Like, I'd seen Interview with a Vampire, but it's sort of, you know, it's a very removed role. And he plays it much differently than I think anything else in his career. And I just really liked sort of this scrappy, you know, attitude of Robert Rodriguez in terms of this movie. And I don't feel like, you know, when you look at some of his earlier movies versus what he's done, you know, in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, there's just something really exciting to me about his early work. This, you know, I'm going to get it done regardless kind of attitude. And I think Desperado is one of those movies that does it. Like, yes, I understand that there's barely a third act to that movie. Like, you know, they show up at Bucha's.
Yeah.
And, like, basically, like, we fade to black and then all of a sudden they're writing off, you know, they're back at the hospital talking to the little kid. But, you know, I mean, I think for me, that's like the best example of like, okay, if you don't have the budget, you know, make it work. And for me, it still worked. Like, for me, I didn't even necessarily need to see him taking down that whole like crime syndicate. I just needed to see where he was going to go as a character next. And I love sort of the back and forth with him and Salma Hayek at the hospital. And then, you know, she's driving the Jeep and he throws it was perfect. I actually didn't even need Once Upon a Time in Mexico because in my brain, like, I had already imagined way more of a story of where they went than what you could get in that movie, and which is, you know, not exactly a really great way to tie it all up, if you ask me. So that movie meant a lot to me, like, when I was a teenager. I loved everything about it. Like, I loved the attitude to it. I just sort of loved the playfulness to certain parts of it. The fact that Joaquin de Almeida is just so good in it. And it's like, as soon as he showed up on 24, I got really excited.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I love this guy. Like, he's like a really good character actor. And I love when he plays villains. And for me, it was just like the minute I fell in love with both Antonio Banderas and Salma Hayek, and was like, I will see them in anything. And I have, you know, and I just think it's a really different movie than we were getting at the time. And I think it was a really great sort of way for Rodriguez to kind of make his mark in, you know, sort of mainstream U.S. cinema. Even though I don't even think it got a huge release, but it definitely got a bigger release than, you know, El Mariachi, which I think just went to like a couple of art house theaters in Chicago for like 2 weekends. So, yeah, I picked Desperado. I love it.
I do, too. I haven't seen it in a couple of years, and the last time I watched it, I was surprised at how well it still held up, because some of those movies, you know, from that period in the 90s that I know you're talking about, where, like, there was sort of this new wave of movies coming in, and we were of a certain age where it was very exciting, you know, and there were all these young filmmakers doing all this cool stuff, and some of those movies you go back and you're like, oh, this doesn't really hold up, you know, like this is very much of its time, and that's okay, but like nowadays it doesn't work as well. And I thought Desperado still held up really, really well. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me, obviously, like you, to divorce it from my nostalgia of the time, because, you know,
oh, yeah,
I saw it in 95. Is it 95?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, fall 95.
So, like, when, you know, when Tarantino shows up in a cameo, of course, I'm like 17 and I'm like, oh my God, Tarantino, yay.
Oh, totally. Absolutely.
Right. It's like I went to see Destiny Turns on the Radio because Tarantino was in it, you know, so I was quite the mark for him. So I liked his little cameo. But, I mean, the whole movie, it's just a really fun, really kick-ass action movie, and it's fun in that, A, you get, you know, a movie of almost entirely Mexican actors being put out by a major studio, and it's like a genre film, you know, two leads who are Mexican actors, and you get to watch both of them become movie stars in the span of 90 minutes, and that's a very rare thing. Sometimes you get one. You very rarely get two where they both are just like electric, you know, and I like Antonio Banderas. I've never liked him more than I do in Desperado. I just think, you know, he has good comic timing and he's really fun in like Expendables 3, right? Is that the one that he's good in?
So you never saw Never Talk to Strangers then, huh?
I have seen Never Talk to Strangers. Don't you worry.
Oh my God. I have
seen Rebecca De Mornay hump him through a chain link fence or whatever the hell happens.
Yeah. Oh my God. That movie, I rented it so much in high school.
I rented it once and that was enough for me.
It wasn't enough for me.
He's a very handsome man, but, you know, so much of. What's that?
And he's Puss in Boots.
He is Puss in Boots. He does. He has a really fun voice. He's a good actor. I'm not saying anything disparaging about his acting abilities, but I think what he does even better than acting is like posture and just look great.
He has a lot of charisma.
He does. He has a lot of charisma. So something like Desperado, you know, which doesn't require a ton of acting, but it does require a certain presence and a certain
swagger.
Physicality. Yeah, I mean, he's just so good in it. And Salma Hayek. So I had seen Antonio Banderas because I remembered him as like Tom Hanks's boyfriend in Philadelphia. So he was kind of on my radar. Salma Hayek was a complete unknown quantity when I saw that movie, and I feel like my life was changed. I was like, my God,
so many
who is
lives
that
were
person? I couldn't even handle it. And they are so great together, and I'm with you 1,000% on what a massive disappointment Once Upon a Time in Mexico is on so many levels, not the least of which how it Ellie Cornell's Selma Hayek.
My God. And it basically writes off Antonio Banderas too, doesn't
yes.
it? Like, yeah, it's just, think about this. Let me put this out to you. How different do you think it would have been in From Dusk Till Dawn if it would have been Antonio Banderas playing George Clooney's brother? I mean, obviously you can't because, you know, Antonio Banderas is Mexican and George Clooney is George Clooney.
Right.
But think about the different dynamic if it would have been Clooney-tang and Antonio Banderas in that movie. Like, I don't think the amount of sexy on the screen in that movie, that like theaters would have gone up.
Yeah.
Like,
no, when Salma Hayek turns into like Snakehead, I'm like, you know what? I would still let that happen. You know?
Yeah. I would have.
I'm not going to be picky. So she has a snakehead. So what? It's still Salma Hayek.
Yeah. Actually, I heard a really fun story about From Dusk Till Dawn really quick. That was actually written on the set of Reservoir Dogs. Maybe somebody knows that out there, but I did not. And I just thought that was really interesting.
Interesting.
I
miss that Robert Rodriguez. You know, like both Desperado and From Dusk Till Dawn, they're messy. Like, they're not, you know, perfectly made movies. I think Desperado is actually a little less messy than From Dusk Till Dawn, but, you know, because he shoots so kind of quick and cheap. But it seemed like he was shooting quick and cheap as a way of trying to make a really good movie. And now quick and cheap is just like his MO and it gives him license to just be kind of shitty. I don't know. Like, I think Desperado might still be his best movie.
Yeah. Also, really quick for Desperado 2, it also put Danny Trejo on the map.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
So, and I just love watching it now because, like, you see, and he's like 40 in that movie. Like, the dude doesn't age. But, like, it just seeing him, like, oh, it's young Danny Trejo, even though he's like 35 in it.
And he'd been around and stuff because, like, I'll go back and watch, like, I think Death Wish 4, he pops up. Like, he's in stuff. But, yeah, Desperado was really the movie where you're like, whoa, wait, who's this guy?
I know, and you just wanted to see more of them, and thank God we got more of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really fun movie. Cool.
All right. What's your first pick?
Oh, I don't have picks. This is just for you. I've talked about my movies before. I'm just interviewing you.
Oh, you're interviewing me? Like, you're not picking movies?
No.
Oh, Jesus.
Nobody cares what I pick. No, this is just about you.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Sorry.
I thought we were both picking movies.
No, I mean, I've talked about, you know... Here's five movies that I love that are not horror. Okay. Back to the Future, Matinee, the 1946 Beauty and the Beast, Wizard of Oz, and, Phantom of the Paradise, which is kind of horror, but not really. So there you go.
Okay.
All right.
Gotcha.
Back to you.
You didn't even put Streets of Fire in? Holy shit.
No, I think if I opened it up to the next five, I think Streets of Fire and like True Romance and a couple other movies would be in there, but.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, I didn't realize this is going to be the Heather show, so this
it's always the Heather show.
Okay. All right. So my next movie that I picked is, you know, real. It's a real high art piece. It's you know, it's got everything. It's got emotions. It's got action, drama, thrill. It's a thrill ride. Mm-hmm. I went with Roadhouse.
I am fascinated by how much Swayze was almost in your top five, because I know one you took off because you announced it. I know one that's still coming, which means we came very close to three Swayzes in your top five.
It's all Swayze all the time. I love Roadhouse. Holy shit. Like, look, again, here's the thing. When you talk about, like, your favorite movies, I don't need movies to be perfect to be my favorite.
No, of course not.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think some people sort of get perfection mixed up with entertaining sometimes, where if a movie isn't perfect, like, oh, that movie was terrible because it had this and this and this wrong. And I was like, yeah, but did you still enjoy yourself?
Right.
You know, and if we're honest, like, Roadhouse has all the subtlety of, you know,
of a brick
like smashing through a window. Like, it's not a subtle movie, but it's freaking awesome. It's a movie that I watch a lot. Actually, it was one of the first movies Brian ever got me.
Nice.
When I got a Blu-ray player. He gave me that and Dude, Where's My Car?
That is not a bad double bill, by the way.
It really isn't, actually. It turned out to be a perfect double bill. it's Swayze. And when in the 80s, like, I know the kids these days, they don't understand it. But in the 80s, like, Swayze was the shit. And it carried over into the 90s, and then something happened, and I don't really know why. But he sort of fell off the radars, which is a bummer, because when you talk again about sort of actors who exude charisma and just have something that so many other actors don't have, like, he's one of those guys. He really is. And I think there's such a genuine earnestness to his performance as Dalton in this really messy world. Where he's just a guy who wants to do the right thing. And I love it. Like, I just do. I think it's got one of the worst sex scenes ever. But I can forgive it, because there's just no way in hell that it's comfortable to have sex on a freaking rock wall. It's just, like, every time I see that, I'm like, oh my God, my back hurts for Kelly Lynch. Like,
when I was a kid, I definitely thought that was, like, a hot scene. And I definitely was like,
it looks,
oh my
great,
gosh, you can have sex standing up. That's so great. And as an adult, right, I'm just like, oh, I'm just looking at the practicality of it instead of, like, whether or not it's sexy. And yeah, exact same. Like, oh, that would never. Oh my God, that seems terrible.
Yeah, I was like, I just like the sort of the physics of that. I'm like, right. I don't really think that works.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, it's freaking Roadhouse. And Sam Elliott's in it too, which, like, come on. I mean, between Swayze and Sam Elliott, like, what else do you need?
How about Terry Funk?
That's true. And Jackie Treehaus.
How about Treehorn? Yeah, Ben Gazzara. How about Jeff Healey Band? How about Kathleen Wilhoit?
Yes. And then also, there's a guy in there that, like, I've seen in, like, a couple other really crazy 80s action movies, and I'm totally blanking on his name right now, because I'm actually not even cheating with IMDb right now.
Who does he play?
I'm blanking on the character name. Like, I know the face. You know what
okay.
I mean? Like,
yeah,
one
yeah,
of those
yeah.
guys, you know the face, and he shows up as, like, sort of a bad guy in a lot of 80s stuff.
Okay.
It's awesome. Like, it's on cable a lot too. Stars plays it a lot, which is why I love Stars, I guess. Actually, they've been playing a lot of Desperado too over the last couple of months.
Does someone who programs Stars, like, have your house bugged?
I think they read my diary is actually how it works. You know,
yeah, Roadhouse was like a basic cable staple years, and I know, I think it was TNT that used to do that Movies for Guys Who Like Movies series, and I think that pretty much started and ended with Roadhouse. Like, I think Roadhouse is the movie that created that movies. Series, right? Just like, coming up next, we're going to run Roadhouse again. Yeah. Swayze is
super... And that's
super...
probably why I loved it so much, because I think it was on, like, cable a lot. I was like, what else would I need to watch but Roadhouse?
And you could definitely watch Roadhouse without the graphic stuff, but I would argue that the graphic stuff makes it way more fun, because you would lose the sex scene. You would lose the throat rip.
And let's be, we're all there just for the throat rip. Once it's established that he's already ripped out somebody else's throat, you just spend the rest of the movie waiting.
That's what we call Chekhov's throat rip. And yes. So Swayze is such an interesting movie star, especially when it comes to like action stuff, because, you know, he's in a handful of these movies that are very much about his sort of machismo, and kind of what an alpha male he is. And yet I think he's one of the few action stars who, and I mean, I don't want to get into like definitions of gender and what is masculine and what is feminine, right? But I think he was much more in touch with things that we would traditionally characterize as feminine, whether it was just a gracefulness, the way he embraced dance. You know, even some of the stuff we see him do in Roadhouse is not stuff that we would see like Chuck Norris or Charles Bronson doing. And there was something sort of uniquely, again, this sounds very black and white, and I don't mean to paint, you know, gender in these broad terms, but I hope everybody knows me well enough to understand what I'm saying. There was something sort of uniquely feminine about his masculinity, and there was no one else like him.
It was also he was also very understated about it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, especially because you look at, like, something, you know, like Dirty Dancing, which, you know, almost made this slot. because it's like, if you think about it, like, again, that was like the movie that sort of broke Patrick Swayze really open. And even if you go back and look at stuff like The Outsiders or Red Dawn,
yeah,
like, he's a guy with his performances, like, it was about, you know, these male roles in these different worlds, but yet there was a thoughtfulness,
yeah,
to what he was doing. And you could always see that regardless of what he was, whatever role he was playing it on a different level than I think actors from his generation were doing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's, again, why I, you know, always really loved his work, is because when you go back and you look at, like, something like The Outsiders, which is a very male-driven movie, for the most part, and, you know, it's these stories about, like, this brotherhood, there's a tenderness to his performance in that movie that anybody else in that role may not have brought that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for, like, Red Dawn, you know? Because it's like you have these kids who are like, you know, all these, you know, invading forces, and, you know, and he has to be tough, but yet he still feels,
right.
And of course, you know, I mean, I know there are some infamous dealings with him and Jennifer Grey on Red Dawn, which they pretty much hated each other.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But really?
No, I really didn't.
Sarcastic?
No, I have serious? Never heard stories about that for real.
Oh my, I can't, you're really not being sarcastic.
I swear, why would I know anything about the making of Red Dawn?
Oh, because it actually ties into the making of Dirty Dancing.
Well, I figured, so, right, that was going to be my next question.
They used to play it on E! All the time, like the E! True Hollywood Story of Dirty Dancing. And they hated each other on Red Dawn. Something happened, because she was just coming off of something where she was starting to, like, click or something, and maybe she was acting a certain way that he didn't like, but they absolutely hated each other on Dirty Dancing. And which is crazy to me because
Dirty
they
Dancing
such,
they hated each other?
They still hated each other. And it's just crazy to me that they have so much chemistry in that film, yet they literally could not be in the same room together when they were not shooting a scene.
No kidding.
Yes. So I miss those days of E! True Hollywood Story. I also read like how the guy who plays Robbie in the movie, the scumbag guy, he actually died in Iraq.
Hmm.
Yeah, he was like a war photographer.
Wow.
Yeah, so you know, E! News really hooked me up with some Dirty Dancing knowledge over the days.
I'm excited for your book about Dirty Dancing.
Oh, well, I got to get through the other non-horror book first before I go to my Dirty Dancing book.
Got it.
So, But yeah, so that's Birdhouse and Patrick Swayze in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a good one. All right, what's next?
All right, so next, no surprise to anybody. This one stars a little actor named Keanu Reeves. One of my very, again, it's funny when everybody says, like, oh, 90s movies sucked. And I'm like, oh, you guys just were watching the wrong shit. I went with Speed.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Like, oh, yes, right? Yeah, I mean, seriously, when that score hits, like, holy crap, I get goosebumps still. That is a movie that I saw in theaters 5 times.
Yeah.
Four times by myself. A friend of mine was like, he saw it like opening night, and the next day he came into work and he's like, oh my God, did you see Speed yet? And I was like, no. And he's like, go after work. And I worked at a convenience store, like probably about like 4 miles from Oprah Mall. And I was like, okay, I'll ride my bike over after work and go see Speed. And sure enough, I did. It was one of those, like, you walk up and you get your ticket, like back in the old days. And I was like, all right. And I freaking loved it. First of all, I was super, super into Dennis Hopper, despite Super Mario Brothers. I just found him so fascinating. And, you know, again, it was like those weird things, like, you know, when in the 90s, like, I became super obsessed with, like, Blue Velvet and weird shit like that. So I was like, oh my God, like, Dennis Hopper's playing a bad guy in an action movie. Yes. And you've got Keanu Reeves teamed up with Jeff Daniels. Like, could the movie get any more 90s? And then it's just awesome. And I know that the ending sort of repeats itself, and I get that. But you don't get if you didn't have that ending, you wouldn't have gotten the line where he says, yeah, but I'm taller. Cause like, I mean, come on. That's like their greatest line of like 1994 cinema. So, you know, I adore Speed a lot. Like, I tend to get like super obsessed with certain movies, and I'll go through like a cycle of like, I'll just watch that. I grew out of that mostly like in high school, but it still kind of pops up now and again. Lately I've been watching a lot of The Cutting Edge, just because it's a good movie to write to. So I know I'm weird. But I remember like even like buying the VHS copy of Speed, and had this offer for the poster and the t-shirt.
Nice.
And I sent away for it, and I got both. And I still remember the heartbreak, because I didn't get to bring, because my Speed poster was huge. It's like 60 by 40.
Holy cow.
So it's a huge poster. And it wouldn't even have fit on my dorm wall in college. So I just left it up at my mom's. And then we ended up moving the summer after my freshman year, and she had packed up a bunch of my stuff. Little did I know, she threw away a bunch of my posters, including my Speed poster. And I was like, I was gutted. Like, I mean, I moved out on my own in like 7 months after that. So I think it probably had to do with the Speed poster. I don't think I ever got over that. But so the nicest thing ever is that, like, but a year or two ago, for I think it was my birthday or maybe Valentine's Day, Brian actually found the poster.
Nice.
And got it off of eBay for me. So I have it again. I have to frame it though, because it's huge, and I don't want to just put it up on my wall like with thumbtacks, like I would in the old days.
Right.
But it's such a really fun action movie that it just felt different than a lot of the action we were getting those days. And I think mid-90s like was a really great time, because you had sort of Die Hard with a Vengeance that sort of brought the fun back to that franchise a little bit. Because I like Die Hard too, but it's a little much sometimes, because it's just like, oh gosh, it doesn't have some of those like sort of iconic set pieces like the original Die Hard did, where you could find yourself like, it was a thrill, where it was just like, oh man, things are just getting worse and worse in Die Hard 2.
Mm-hmm.
You know, planes are blowing up with lots of people in it and stuff like that. Like, it's kind of depressing in a way.
Yeah, entire buildings blow up in Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Yes.
That's how the movie literally opens.
But yeah. it has Simon Says in it. So, yeah, you know.
I like 2 better than 3, but I know I'm in a minority there.
Yeah, I think you are. no, I like 2, but I think 3 is a lot more fun. And I just, you know, it's like it's got that sweaty New York, you know, summer feel to it, you know, even though it kind of cheats its cheats it a little bit on one of the games that they play. I'll still figure it out. But yeah, I just there's something a little fun and a little freeing about mid-90s action movies. And Speed, like, to me, like, when that bus drop jump hits, like, I still remember the first time seeing it. Like, people, like, were standing up and cheering in the theater. Like, and I don't remember a lot of movies that you get that kind of emotion from. Right. And I even remember, like, in the Chicago Sun-Times, they did a huge article about the physics of how of whether or not you could actually do that, and then how they actually achieved it. Because they really did do a bus jump, but it was, like, a completely hollowed-out bus, and it had to be going a certain amount of speed and all this kind of stuff. And I actually, somewhere in, like, my crap that lives in my aunt's basement in Chicago, there I actually still have that article. Because that's how much I loved it. I was like, I was one of those, like, I would cut stuff out of, like, newspapers. I have a ton of U2 articles from, like, 15 years of stuff. Yeah, I would clip out newspaper articles. I was weird. But yeah, so Speed is definitely up there. It's so good. And it's anytime somebody says pop quiz, I'm like, yeah, I'm right there.
Right. Pop quiz, hot shot. No, Speed is a masterpiece, and I think one of the best action movies ever made. And I say this as someone who has seen a lot of action movies and knows a lot about action movies. I remember seeing it. There was like a sneak preview. I maybe had like 1 week of whatever year I was in high school left, like sophomore or junior. And it was on a Friday night, and I went to see it by myself. And nobody really knew anything about it. Keanu Reeves was not taken super seriously by this point. You know, he had kind of a string of flops since 91, and so nobody was expecting big things from this action movie starring Keanu Reeves. And like, the premise is dumb, right? The bus can't slow down. Okay, I mean, that's like whatever. And so I went in with, you know, very few expectations. I just had been a Keanu Reeves fan for many years, and I mean, I came out of it like I would not shut up to anyone who would listen about, like, you know, there's this movie Speed coming out Friday. You have to go. And they're like, what? The bus movie with that guy? Yeah, I promise. It's so good. It's so good. I was telling everyone who would listen. So I went again opening weekend and saw it. I don't know. Maybe I might have only seen it like 3 times. I don't think I made it to 5. But and for many years, I was making the case that Keanu Reeves had starred in like 3 of the 5 best action movies ever made, between Point Break, Speed, and The Matrix. And just to prove me right, he then also made John Wick 1 and 2, which I would also put on that list. He may be the greatest action star of all time, which is hilarious because I don't think he's considered
An action star,
not first. I mean, people recognize, like, yeah, he's made a lot of action movies, but, like, he's not, like, a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone or a Bruce Willis or these guys. When you say action star, Keanu Reeves isn't the first name that comes to mind. And yet, he has made more genuinely great action movies than probably anyone else. And
Thank God he never got caught up in all that Expendables stuff. Because, like, I think if he would have gotten into those movies, like, I don't think we would have had John Wick with him.
Right. No, Speed is amazing and is a reminder of how good action movies can be. You know, I mean, you see so many and they're all just like, well, that was okay, that was fun. And then you see one that genuinely stands out because it has smart dialogue and interesting characters and good performances. And people,
and it's so quotable too, by the way. Like, to get an action movie that's not tied to like a franchise, because, you know, I mean, I know there's Speed 2, but that doesn't exist, and I refuse to acknowledge its existence. But like, I quote Speed all the time. Like, so many times we'll be driving and I'll be like navigating or whatever, and Brian will be like, just give me the phone, and be like, take the phone.
Oh yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, come on. Like, Glenn Plummer, like, of course, from Showgirls, is, you know, Mr. Toon Man, as his license plate says. Like, there's so much good stuff in that movie. Like, that was Jane DeBont's, like, first directing gig, right?
Yes.
Like, that's insane to me.
Yeah, he nailed it and then never was as good again.
I know, man.
I'm not a big Twister guy, but...
Yeah, I'm not either.
Yeah. Let's keep that to ourselves. People will get mad.
I know they're going to get mad at me, but I don't. Sorry, guys. It's Helen Hunt. It's just, I can't.
No, she's not the problem for me. But yeah, Speed's great. What is, I guess this would be your two.
Yes. Yeah, so my two, my number two is Clue. I didn't even mean to write it that way. Oh, yes. Yeah, Clue is like a classic. Like, I just, when I need a movie to take me to my happy place, like, probably it's going to be, you know, one of three or four movies, and Clue is one of those. It was a movie, like, as a kid, most people didn't know what the hell I was talking about. They just thought
I was talking about the movie.
They didn't have a clue.
I'm ending the podcast.
We're just going to do a series of dad jokes for the rest of the episode. No, I saw Clue when I was a kid. And actually, the first time I ever saw it, I only saw the version where it's Miss Scarlet as the killer. And then my best friend, Jenna, her dad had a friend tape it off of HBO, and it had the multiple endings, and my mind was blown. I was like, wait, this is what? Like, I didn't realize. I had no idea because I rented it from the video store. And I think at that point, they'd only done, like, the singular ending. There's a version of the VHS that was just, I think it was just the Miss Scarlet version. And then when it went to cable for some reason, maybe to fill out running time, I'm not sure, they did all three endings together. And maybe I'm wrong in that, but I know for a fact the first time I saw it, I only saw the Miss Scarlet ending. So I was like, wait, Miss Peacock did it in this version? And I'm like, wait, it was everybody? Like, I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. Talk about like perfect casts from top to bottom. It's Clue. Like, and I know they're going to remake Clue. It's fine. You know, I've lived through a lot of remakes in my day. And I'm pretty confident in the team behind it, because I don't think they're just going to go and try to remake this version of Clue. And I think there is a way to make Clue now. Like, for me, I kind of hope they set it in the 80s and kind of bring it a few decades up. Mm-hmm. Because I think you could still have a lot of fun with it and not have to try to be this version. But, I mean, it's like, it's Tim Curry. It's Michael Keane. It's, you know, Leslie Ann Warren. It's Madeline Kahn, for Christ's sakes. Like, holy crap. Like, it is such an embarrassment of comedy riches in this movie. And every line is pitch perfect. Martin Mull, like, who I just, you know, and then when he shows up on Roseanne, like, I was like, oh my God, this is great. You know, it's Colonel Mustard on Roseanne. You know, I know we're not supposed to talk about Roseanne anymore, but, like, as a kid, when Martin Mull started being on that show, like, I was like, this is so cool. Like, Colonel Mustard's on my TV every week now. I don't know. It's such a great movie. I love murder mysteries. I love old-timey movies. I like talkies, as we call them in our house. And this movie is all of those things wrapped into one. And this is how I knew that I was meant to be with Brian, is the very first night we met. And we were talking about, like, movies or whatever. And we're at a Friday the 13th party, so there's no reason to bring up anything but horror. Because, again, you're in the horror circles. And we don't talk about things that aren't horror, usually. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, when I was a kid, I was, like, super obsessed with this one movie. And, like, you know, my best friend, because Jenna, like, I would always either watch Friday, Fright Night, Terror in the Aisles, or Clue. And she would just get so fed up with me. And so basically, like, you know, I was like, yeah, I was really obsessed with this one movie when I was a kid. I think we were just talking about Tim Curry in general, and I was like, oh, and he was like, is it Clue? And I was like, yes. And I was like, you know about Clue? And he's like, I know about Clue. He's like, it's one of my favorite movies. And I was like, what? So I'm like, I mean, at that point, I was like, yeah, you know, I don't need to co-date anybody else. Like, this guy likes Clue. I was like, I'm never going to find one of those again. You know, and it's just, it's so good. Like, every time, like, it's, like, a little overcast out here, because it doesn't happen very often. And especially if it rains, Clue goes on. And, like, we bought the Mondo sound score a few years ago. And it's, like, the minute that music hits, I'm, like, I'm transported, and I'm driving in a car with Christopher Lloyd. And there's, you know, Leslie Ann Warren trying to fix her car. And it's just, it's so damn good. And I don't know that anybody listening to this probably hasn't seen Clue, or maybe they haven't, and I'm just overestimating sort of the cult value of this movie. But if you have never seen Clue, do yourself a favor. Just don't even listen to the rest of this episode. Stop now.
Take it easy. Go watch Clue. They can listen to the rest. It's fine.
Okay.
But then they can watch Clue.
Yes, but they should really watch Clue. It's just, it's so good. And I just, when you talk about, like, 80s comedies that are, like, pitch perfect, like, I put this up with, like, A Fish Called Wanda. Like, it's right up there. I think in terms of cast, script, tone, you know, like, every beat works. It's just, it's so good.
It is. It's really fun, really funny. And, you know, there was that brief period, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago when it was like they were making Battleship and Ridley Scott was going to make Monopoly, and it was like, why are we making movies out of board games? And you kind of forget that, well, Clue was based on a board game because the movie transcends those roots and just becomes its own great little comedy thing. I don't know if this is a like a Mandela effect thing or not. My memory is that when I used to watch it on cable as a kid, that they would show different endings. So, like, you felt lucky if you caught it and it was the one with all the endings, right? It was like, ooh, yay. But then I feel like a couple of years ago I looked into it and it saw that, like, the only version that ever aired was the one with all the endings. And I'm just remembering that sometimes you would get just the one ending. So I don't remember which is which. If somebody's listening and they know the answer, please comment. But I would always yes. stick around and watch the whole movie because I was like, well, which ending are they going to show? And of course, the one with all the endings is the best one. Anything else is inferior. It's also funny that as a kid who hadn't, you know, seen as many movies, obviously, I had so little frame of reference for most of the cast. So I kind of knew who Madeline Kahn was because I had seen, you know, maybe some Mel Brooks at that point. I knew who Martin Mull was because I had seen Mr. Mom so many times.
Yes.
And, like, maybe I knew that Christopher Lloyd had also played Doc, but I couldn't necessarily reconcile the two of them. I'm sure somebody explained to me that, you know, Michael McKean was on Laverne and Shirley, but I couldn't reconcile those two things. And everybody else, you know, I had no frame of reference for Leslie Ann Warren or Miss Peacock. Eileen Brennan? No.
Yes,
Eileen Brennan. Or Tim Curry, you know, because I hadn't seen Rocky Horror or anything like that. So this was my introduction to so many of these people. So it's not really until I'm older and I'm looking at, my God, look at the cast of this movie, that you really realize, like, what an insane all-star ensemble it is.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah, I had known Tim Curry because I think I'd seen Legend before I'd seen this, and I was like, wait, that guy was the devil dude?
Right.
I was like, oh my God, because he's, like, scary. And then I think I saw Rocky Horror after my first time of seeing Clue. So yeah, it was, like, one of those where, like, you realize, like, what good, like, how great actors can just be so chameleon-like.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, Tim Curry is just, like, the personification of that. And I think that was, like, when I realized, like, oh my God, this guy is amazing, and I'll watch him pretty much again in anything, and have, for better or for worse.
Including McHale's Navy.
Oh, I actually saw that in theaters.
Oh, boy. All right, so we are up to number one. It's not like I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I mean,
we've named a Swayze. We've named a Keanu. Now, if only there was a way.
A movie that brought them together.
To somehow get them together with a tank girl. And a Red Hot Chili Pepper.
And also a drunk uncle from Silver Bullets.
And a drunkle.
And eventually, a crazy doctor from Scrubs.
Sadly, no such movie exists. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Yeah, I mean, come on. It's Point Break. Like, I mean, I could have just done Point Break 5 times if you wanted. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I just, what do you say about the perfect movie? I don't even know. It's weird because, like, I have a real huge emotional connection to Point Break. Like, it's amazing and it's awesome and it's kick-ass. And it's, I think, one of the very best action movies to come out of the 90s. But for me, it has, like, this big emotional resonance. Just because I remember it was summer of 91. Yep. And my aunt Florence had been sick. And I had stayed out because she lived in the city. So I stayed out with them for a couple weeks during the summer, during summer break. So I remember it was July, I think, when it came out. And so I remember my cousin Melissa, who was like a few years older than me, she had done, like, she had to do like her driving training because, like, she, with the Chicago Public Schools, they had to do like special private training for driving stuff. I don't know. So we were there for a couple hours, and afterwards my aunt was like, hey, let's go to a movie. And so her other daughter, Sherry, drove us over, and we went to see Point Break because we were like, ooh, Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves is in a movie. That sounds fun. And, you know, and I was completely enthralled the entire time, and I loved it. But it was like this weird thing at the end where, like, you know, it's this huge moment, you know, where basically Patrick Swayze is deciding he would rather die than go to prison, you know, because it's not tragic to die doing what you love. And I just remember, like, looking at my aunt, who, you know, was basically 4 months away from dying at this point. I mean, you know, she probably knew better than any of us, like, what, how much the clock was ticking. I don't think she really told people as sick as she was. And I just remember seeing her crying at that, like, as the movie ended. And I thought, like, wow, that was an interesting thing. And then I realized, like, it was like the first moment I realized that movies could be more than just movies. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, I was only like, you know, 13 at the time. You know, movies were just kind of entertainment to me and an escape. And I didn't really make me realize that movies that weren't like trying to be emotionally manipulative could just evoke an emotional response. Like, you watch Beaches because you know you're going to cry. You're going to watch Steel Magnolias because you need a good cry. And you want to watch some really great ladies put on performances, but you know you're going to cry. Do you know what I mean? Like, that movie is setting you up for this big emotional moment. Where Point Break is like a movie about bank robbers and surfers and this guy at the FBI who just, you know, is trying to figure his life out and trying to figure out what he wants to do because he's in, you know, this system that, you know, basically he's really good at what he does, but he doesn't feel like he's, you know, he's connecting more with this outsider world, and he's struggling with that. And just seeing, like, my aunt basically watching this guy, like, accepting death. And I think that was just, like, a real, like, eye-opening moment for me as a kid. Like, I think I realized, like, what mortality was at that point, which is weird. Because, like, when you're a little kid, you don't think about those things, really. And I think that was me for the first moment where I realized, like, whoa, okay. And so it just really always stuck out to me in that way. Like, of course it's great because it's Keanu Reeves, you know, working with Patrick Swayze, doing some really incredible things, like, in terms of the scope of the action. Patrick Swayze jumps out of an airplane for real. You have Kathryn Bigelow, who, you know, at this point had only done a couple of smaller movies. You know, Near Dark is great, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't nearly the level of what was going on in Point Break. And I don't mean that as a derogatory thing. It just, budget-wise, story-wise, ambitious-wise, it just, it was a completely different animal. And of course, you know, she was dating Cameron at the time, so, or was with Cameron at the time, so, you know, some folks would be like, oh, well, we know why she got it, but I think she proved why she deserved it with that movie. And it made me an immediate fan of hers. It's just, it's such a special and different movie. Again, if you look at something like Speed, like, it's a very, you know, point A, point B, point C, and of course kind of point D because we sort of recycle our ending, you know, and Point Break, it's just, it's such a different thing. Like, it's just, it's so much more than just the action. You know, it's basically, you know, and these are things that I thought about, you know, as I struggled in my 30s to figure out just what the hell I wanted to do with my life. And it sounds so stupid, but there's like movies like Point Break where, you know, I'd be watching like, God, you know, what am I doing? Like, I don't love this world that I'm in. Like, how do I change this? How do I figure out what it is that I want to do? And for me, it's just, it's always been a movie that's, you know, it's entertaining. It's great. It's, you know, enjoyable. It's fun. It's got really great performances and all this stuff. But like, for me, it's like, I don't know that I would be out here if it wasn't for this. And it sounds stupid to say that. I mean, I probably would be out here, but there was a lot in me, especially like when I was kind of going through like my divorce and then ended up basically losing my job at the same time and had a lot of downtime. And I watched Point Break a lot because I was like, okay, you know, maybe I don't want to throw myself out a window, you know, in this house that I had built and now I can't afford it. And now my life is like crumbling and stuff, but it's like, I would watch that and I'd be like, God, this is where I need to go. And it just sounds stupid because I know I was like, oh, you just, you know, use a movie as your motivation for life. But I do. Like, I look at these, you know, there's a lot of different movies that I've looked at in terms of, you know, what are they saying about what we strive to do with, you know, our humanity? Like, do you want to spend your life doing these things that you don't care about, that you don't love, you know, or do you want to follow something that you really believe in, that's something that makes you feel good about what you're doing? And like, it was one of those movies. So I don't know. It's just, it's so perfect. And it's just, I don't know. Like, I remember the first time, like when I saw Scrubs come onto TV and I was like, oh my God, I was like, it just blew my mind seeing John C. McGinley. And he like, and I didn't give a crap about Zach Braff, and I knew Donald Faison from, you know, Clueless, but that was like it. And I remember What's-Her-Face from the Drew Carey Show, but it was like me. I was watching Scrubs because of John C. McGinley, because of Point Break.
Right.
You know, so I just think there's so much good stuff in that movie. And, you know, I know it's sort of like the butt of jokes because it's like, oh, you know, Keanu Reeves is such a blank slate in that movie. But he has to be, because he is. He's like the character that is reacting to everything going on. Like, he's a kid who just came in from Ohio, basically had his whole life like structured, and just these experiences made him realize like he doesn't know shit about anything. Like, he thinks he knows what success is, and he thinks he knows what living his life is, but it's none of those things that he's been taught. You know, and I say that lovingly as somebody who used to go to Point Break Live, because, like, the whole part of that experience was the fact that you would go in and be Keanu Reeves because it's such a blank performance, anybody could do it. But I don't think that's true. I think that there is something very subtle to the way that Catherine and Keanu work through that character, where it isn't, you know, it's not just him sort of being, like, you know, a grown-up, you know, Ted. Like, there's something more to that. So I'll stop rambling. But yeah, no, I could literally just sit here and, like, literally talk about Point Break for, like, 6 hours. So just stop me.
No, listen, I would be the person to talk to about it because I love it very much as well. And I disagree, right, with people that say Keanu was totally blank. I have this whole theory that, like, the movie is sort of this, it completely mirrors, like, who he was in his career at the time. I think it's a great action movie. I love that its legacy has gone from, like, sort of being ridiculed because it's, you know, this bank robbing surfer movie where, you know, the lead guy says, whoa. And then it was sort of ironically embraced for many years, and now I feel like it's come around to where people are just like, oh no, you know, Point Break is just actually awesome.
Yeah, I was not a happy camper during the ironic love phase because I'd see people doing that on like social media and I'd be like, just stop. Like, yeah. There's nothing ironic to love about this movie. This movie is great. Like, I'm glad we're past that now because at least it makes me less angry.
Yeah, no, for sure. You know, I remember seeing it in 91 and, you know, that was a huge year for movies, especially for me at that age. And there were so many movies that came out that summer that, you know, my friends were talking about or wanted to talk about Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and especially, you know, Terminator 2, but even like Backdraft and
Return to the Blue Lagoon,
Return to the Blue Lagoon, Naked Gun 2.5. You know, there were all these movies. And the one that I wanted to talk about was Point Break. But Point Break, guys, right? Like, can we talk about Point Break? That was the one that I was the most sort of excited about. And yeah, I've just been a lifelong lover of that movie. So
it's perfect.
It is. What did not make your list?
Well, as we said, Dirty Dancing. I know it's goofy, but God damn it. I still get the chills when she does lift at the end and I don't care. Again, a movie that's sort of based around music. Like, you know, it's all I need is some good music. I didn't put like Little Shop of Horrors on there because I felt like it went a little too much into genre for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled that back, because I do love Little Shop of Horrors. I almost went with Wayne's World, but I know how you feel about Wayne's World, so you're a monster.
I have nothing against Wayne's World. It's fine. It just holds for laughs. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
I know. I'm just joking with you. I'm trying to think. There was, I almost put Clerks, and then I almost put Clerks 2, because both of those movies meant something very different to me at the time. I still think Clerks, the first one, is one of the best movies sort of just, again, when you talk about like do-it-yourself filmmaking, I really think, you know, and I know people give Kevin Smith a lot of shit, and I feel like thankfully we're kind of backing off of that a little bit when we almost lost him, which I was really, I'm not grateful that we almost lost him, but I'm grateful to see people realize like, oh, maybe we're just being needlessly mean to this guy for no reason.
Yeah.
Because there's no reason, you know, the dude, like whether you like his movies or not, he always makes them from the heart and there's nothing to be shamed about with that. You know, they just may not be for you and that's fine. So I think for me, like Clerks really was like that moment where one, I was working at a convenience store. So I found a lot to relate to in that movie. But I just thought it was such an interesting way. Like I just never had seen a movie like that before. And then when Clerks 2 came around, it was sort of right around the time when I realized, oh goodness, I am not really happy in my marriage, but I'm in this thing. Do I just stick it out? And I just realized maybe I didn't have to. And maybe there was something greater waiting out there for me. And it just, I think there's some really, there's some really ugly moments to Clerks too that I have a hard time reconciling these days. But I think once you get past that, there's a really beautiful story in there, that really just fills me with a lot of joy. And I think Rosario Dawson is so cute in that movie and I just love her. And I think she's just, you know, she makes that movie so wonderful. But there's definitely some stuff with Randall that I wish they would have toned down, because I think there's some moments that really just go a little further than they needed to.
Yeah.
And I'll leave it at that. and then Wayne's World, yeah, I was such a freaking 90s kid. Like, I just, everything about Wayne's World on Saturday Night Live was, like, my favorite shit ever. And then when that movie came along, I just, that was the moment where I was like, oh, my God, I'm in love with Mike Myers. not Michael Myers, but Mike Myers. And was just immediately indoctrinated into that cult. And then realized like, oh, So I Married an Axe Murderer is fantastic. But that movie, like, I love quotable movies. I don't know how to, it's just, I like movies where it's like sipping like a familiar cup of like tea or something. Like you just know it and everything about it feels right. And you can just sort of, you know, every note to it. And when I was in high school, I had a group of friends, because it was back, like, my mom was always kind of militant about phone use. But we were living with my aunt at the time for my freshman year of high school, which, by the way, I do not recommend if you're in high school having to share a bedroom with your parents. It sucks. Mm-hmm. And you get very little privacy. So I would sneak down in the middle of the night downstairs, and I would turn on Wayne's World on the TV, and me and a group of my friends, like, we even had, like, a thing where, like, we would call each other at 1 a.m., and I would turn the ringer off on the phone and just like pick it up every couple of seconds to right. see if they were calling at right. that time. And we would do synchronized Wayne's World in the middle of the night.
Nice.
And we would just like quote along and everything. And I remember one time, like my Uncle Tom came downstairs and like, was like, what are you doing? And I was like hiding the phone with the phone cord coming from like the kitchen to the living room under the pillows. And I was like, I'm just watching Wayne's World. And he's like, okay. So yeah. And I think another one too is also probably Strange Brew. I just really love Bob and Doug McKenzie, and it's just, again, I think it's Rick Moranis, just really makes a lot of things, you know, work for me. And so that was like another movie that like, as a teenager, like I just loved Strange Brew. So, you know, those are some of my non-horror picks.
Interesting that, yeah, Strange Brew is very much a precursor to Wayne's World. That was like a childhood staple for me. I have not seen it, I don't think, as an adult. But, man, as a kid, I watched Strange Brew religiously.
Yeah, the last time I owned it was on VHS. And I just never got around to getting it on DVD. I would love to rewatch. I think there's a Blu-ray, too, that came out a few years ago. There was like a special edition or something. But I just never got around to you know, rebuying it, right, I suppose.
Right. All right. Well, this was fun. Thank you for talking about non-horror movies. I promise to never make you do it again.
I feel like it. Well, yeah. I don't literally know any other movies now.
No,
this
I know.
Is it. This is the extent of my film education.
We've exhausted these titles, and now we can just go back to talking about horror. That's fine.
There you go.
Anyway, it's always super fun for you to be on, and everybody's always excited when you come on. So thank you. Thank you guys very much for listening. As always, you can find us every day at fthismovie.com, on Twitter at fthismovie, on Stitcher, and we might be on Spotify now. I don't know. But Heather, where can people find you online?
You can find me over at dailydead.com. And then if you're over on the Twitterses, you can find me at The Horror Chick.
Yes, please do.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, thank you guys very much for listening. We will talk to you next week. Bye, Heather. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.